Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 334. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in thisshowissogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. So excited for this week's show. We must get started with our guest. Mark S. King is an award-winning blogger, author, and HIV/AIDS advocate who has been involved in HIV causes since testing positive in 1985. His award-winning writing, which you must read, we're going to provide so many links to it. It's been featured in The Advocate, Newsweek, The Washington Blade, and on the body.com website. He has been honored for his writing so many flippin' times, including the 2007-2008 National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association's Award for Best Opinion Piece of the Year for his essay, Once When We Were Heroes. We're going to talk about that. He is the author of A Place Like This, his memoir of life in Los Angeles during the dawn of the AIDS epidemic. Mark was included in the POS 100, the 100 people and ideas that POS magazine finds most inspiring. In November of 2012, Instinct magazine named Mark one of their leading men of 2012. His blog, My Fabulous Disease, which I hope you all know, it was awarded the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association's first Excellence in Blogging honor in 2014, and it was nominated for a 2015 GLAAD Media Award. This year, in 2015, HIV Equal named Mark one of their 13 legendary activists in the fight against HIV. Honestly, he has so many other credentials and so many other awards, but we're going to stop here so that we actually have a chance to chat with him. Mark, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much. I'm exhausted.
Mark, we have no time left now.
Yes. Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
I think we made a real difference. I think we made a real difference with the reading of that.
Well, certainly. Absolutely. In my resume, you know, because you mentioned some things I forgot. I was jotting them down, you know, while you were talking.
That's why we do this, to remind you of your accomplishments. It's a good thing,
yeah,
Mark. It's a good thing.
I appreciate that.
We have so much to chat about, Mark. Are you ready?
Oh, please.
I have to tell you where I started. I started my day by watching a clip of you winning a car on The Price is Right.
Oh, no. Yes. Oh, my God. You know, yes, that's true. I did. I won a car on The Price is Right. I was 19 years old, and I went to CBS Studios just to take a tour, and there was this line forming, you know, to see The Price is Right. And I don't know if you noticed when you watched the clip, but that's my boyfriend in the audience, and we're wearing matching outfits.
Yes, you are. It was either the best figure skating team ever, or you were boyfriends.
Yeah, oh no, we were boyfriends. And Johnny Olson, who old queens will know, was the announcer on The Price is Right for many years, was standing by the cameraman there on the side of the stage. And according to my friends who were also there, he kept pointing to Charlie, my boyfriend at the time, pointing to Charlie saying, get him, show him, you know, like reaching his arm out, pointing at Charlie, because Charlie was going nuts. If you'll notice, I was like catatonic on stage. I was terribly cute, don't get me wrong, but I was so in shock by what was going on. Meanwhile, Charlie was like jumping out of his chair, and so he was a much better contestant. He really should have been on stage instead of me.
But you won the car, and that's the important thing. It's very exciting, Mark.
Yes, absolutely. It is. A 1980 Pontiac Phoenix LJ Coupe wheel covers.
I love it. I read that you gave that car to your sister.
I did.
Okay.
I did. It showed up at the car dealership. I drove it off the lot and 6 hours from New Orleans to my hometown and into my sister's driveway.
Amazing. Amazing.
That's the kind of brother I am.
And don't let her forget it.
I don't. Oh,
there you go.
Me. Oh, yeah.
Now, in the what I would deem a classic exchange with Bob Barker, when the car is pulled out there on the stage, Bob Barker asks you, do you have a girlfriend there in New Orleans? What was Mark King's response to that question?
In a lilting, very young gay voice, I responded, several. Because what was I going to do? Now, do you know that people create, you know, that this whole thing is on YouTube, and I get criticized. People will leave comments saying, well, why didn't you come out? Why didn't you tell them who you were? I'm like, how old are you? Because this was 1980, and, you know, people weren't popping out of the closet on The Price is Right.
Right.
You know, that's just not what was going on. And so, you know, I was back against the wall. And I didn't want, you know, I don't think that there's some little piece of me that thought, if I say something like that, they're going to kick me off this show. And I want to stick around to win the car.
You did. You did. Although I will tell you, and I am a game show fanatic, Mark. So seeing you on there, very exciting for me. The only thing that would have made it more exciting is if you had somehow been on Match Game between Charles Nelson Reilly and Brett Summers. But other than that. So my favorite part is, so for avid Price is Right folks, you played the game where you have to guess the price of the car and you have to give a dollar for every number that you're off.
Yes.
And I have to say, in my many years of watching The Price is Right, I've never seen someone actually count the dollar bills to make sure that they were given the correct amount at the start.
Yeah, well, you know, I was a nervous thing to do, but Bob Barker certainly caught me on that one. And it was, what are you counting him, Mark? Don't you trust me? But yeah.
Amazing.
I was just trying to be, you know, game show adorable.
Mark, I hope that you know you were game show adorable.
Yeah.
It was well done. It was well done.
Well, thanks.
Well, let's talk about the 80s. We flash forward a little bit. When I was looking at different dates of different things that you've accomplished in your life, I was seeing, is this correct? Am I getting the timeline correct? That you actually started volunteering for AIDS-related agencies before you found out about your own diagnosis?
Yeah, that's true. You know, I started volunteering before there was an HIV test. You know, things started happening before we even had a test for what was going on. And so yeah, that's true. That's true.
What drove you to do that?
It was just weird and scary.
Yeah.
And what drove me to do that? Gosh, you know, it felt like something to do. You know, I'll tell you, it felt like charity work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'll have a garden party and we'll all wear white gloves. You know, it just felt like something to do, but it did not affect me at all. It seemed very far away. But it felt like something to do. And
yeah.
I guess what I want to say is it hadn't really had its full impact on our community. It hadn't even begun really to have the impact it eventually would. And so I can't really say that I didn't even do it at that point because, you know, all my friends were dying, you know, which became the case, or it certainly felt like that within another couple of years.
Yeah. Mark, I've asked this question so many times over the past 7+ years of doing the show, and I will pose it to you as well. How would you go about talking about the 80s to our younger listeners out there who just maybe don't have a sense of what it was really like? How do you even go about wrapping your mind around it?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it was the best of times and the worst of times.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things where we were all on this horrible roller coaster ride, and it was really, really scary, except, you know, the tracks were missing, you know, in various places, and people would go veering off into the dark, you know, it's been often described as a war and being in a foxhole and the bullets are whizzing by, and that's certainly true. It's amazing because, you know, people talk about, you know, oh, we were all so courageous and heroic and all of those things. And I guess that many of us might have chosen to ignore what was going on or to just put our head in the sand. And a lot of people did. They just didn't want to confront it head on. It was too horrible. And it was. But for those of us like me who were living in West Hollywood, it was inescapable.
Yeah.
So you could not escape what was going on. And I felt like I sleepwalked through a few years where I was just shell-shocked. You know, it was just like, okay, who's in the hospital? Where do I need to go now? What's the next task? What do I need to get accomplished? Who needs the pills and who should I visit? And, oh, somebody's moving into the guest room to die.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just like trying to just put one foot in front of the other and get through it.
Yeah.
And also in an environment in which, you know, everybody said, well, this is God's punishment, we're going to hell. And for someone like me, who was in my early 20s at the time, you know, coming from a small Louisiana town where I had messages like that delivered to me throughout my childhood,
right,
there's a piece of you, there was a piece of me that believed it, that started to believe it. Well, maybe they're right.
Yeah.
Maybe I am going to hell. Maybe this is God's punishment, because I don't see any evidence to suggest otherwise. I see a lot of evidence to suggest these people are right, you know, and you couldn't help that piece of you inside that said, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, I am sinful, and now look, all of my gay friends are dying.
Right.
And so I guess the most horrific part was a piece of us, and I think that it wasn't just limited to me. A little piece started to believe that maybe all of these people, these, you know, religious conservatives, were right.
Yeah.
And that might be the most awful part, for you to actually believe, not kind of in a theoretical way, like a debate on Facebook, but in a real life way, I am forsaken.
Yeah.
I am truly forsaken by my God, and I'm going to die. And he's making it happen. So that's probably the worst part of it. And then on the flip side, of course, you got to see the greatest in humanity possible. You know, you got to see friends gather around friends and take care of the people that were, you know, gosh, you know, the friends that we helped in their dying process, you know, and did so in the absence of their families who chose not to be there for whatever reason. So you had all of these really wonderfully deep things, but, you know, I'll spend all of my life wondering, was it worth it to have become so intimate with death and dying and mortality and the meaning of life and God and all of these things so young, you know, when, I don't know, maybe I would have preferred to have been, you know, just frivolous and young and stupid for a few more years as opposed to having to learn some real hard truths about, you know, our own mortality so soon.
Yeah. You wrote this in that essay, Once When We Were Heroes, you wrote this, quote, "To say I missed that brutal decade would only be partially true. I missed the man I was forced to become when an entire community abandoned tea dances for town hall meetings, when I learned to offer help to those facing what terrified me most." So
Yeah. There
is that piece where, even just as an individual who's reading that to you right now, you know, I am 38 years old, so my real coming out was in the 90s. So I don't know really a time where an entire community abandoned tea dances for town hall meetings. How do you bring that sentiment forward? How important, I guess maybe let's go back a step and make it more general, how important is it to bring that sensibility forward to what we're trying to do now?
I don't know if there's going to be, and that's kind of the thing. You know, I also say in that essay that the best man I will ever be lived 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Because that's when I was called up to be that guy.
Right.
You know, when I was called up to be that guy and start getting involved in my community and fight this terrible thing.
Yeah.
A terrible thing, the likes of which we haven't seen since. And that's just true. We haven't. And it's not as if we're not heroic people anymore, but we haven't been called up to that degree. But just imagine if, you know, and we see it to other, we see it in other aspects of our life. We have a presidential candidate right now that, you know, is saying all of these fascist things and all of that. What if he went a few steps further? What if he said, you know, gay people should not be welcome in this country. They should be quarantined.
Right.
They should be sent off to islands. All of the things that were actually being suggested back in the 1980s about us.
Right.
You know, what would you do? Would you say, okay, that's it. I draw the line. I'm getting on the phone. What do I do? Where do I volunteer? How can I speak out against this person? You know, where do I get involved to make this stop? And I guess that AIDS presented such a stark example of clearly a life and death example of, you can either work to stop this or you can just be one of the many that roll over and die.
Yeah.
And literally die.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we have a Stark as an example. And you know what? That's okay with me.
Right.
You know, a lot of people say, oh, these kids today, they just don't, you know, if they had lived through what I had lived through, you know, because trust me, although I love to chronicle what happened to us and tell the story, and that's really important, I am by no means one of those guys waving the rake on the lawn saying, oh, you kids today, if only you had seen what I'd seen. I don't want you to see what I saw.
Yeah.
I don't want you to see that. And by the way, I have a lot more compassion for your behavior and your choices than maybe a lot of people of my generation, or even young, you know, other young people. In other words, sexuality and what the choices we make and who uses a condom and who doesn't and who cares about, you know, all of these things get wrapped up in name calling and stuff, as opposed to being seen as very human behaviors. And as much as people want to harken back to the 80s and AIDS, saying, look how terrible it was, use a condom, damn it, you know, the fact is that we weren't pointing fingers at each other back in the 80s about who was using a rubber and who wasn't, or who got infected or who wasn't. You know, we were just doing our best to bury the dead.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, and this was after we knew what HIV was, but after we knew how you got it, we still weren't pointing fingers saying, how dare you get infected? You know, condom usage was not significantly higher in the 80s than it is now.
Right.
You know, we have always had a problem with delaying gratification, or you know, being gratified to the greatest extent possible. That is just a human need.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that the 80s gets thrown up in people's faces as some sort of place of time of great sexual austerity, you know, in the slaughter of the innocents or something, when in fact, you know, these are all ongoing issues. And so, boy, did I just blather out a whole lot?
I love it. I love it.
Is still on?
We're still here. And listeners, you're still here. Listeners, you're listening to Mark S. King, award-winning blogger, author, HIV, AIDS advocate. I'm actually quite intrigued by that word advocate, Mark, that's on your bio. What is the difference in your mind? Do you consider yourself to be an advocate versus an activist, an advocate and an activist? Is there a difference between the two?
Holy Truvada, that is a mouthful right there. Because it's, you know, it's funny, you know, as a wordsmith, as somebody who writes, I think to my, sometimes when describing myself for, I don't know, some event or whatever I'm going, I will put advocate. And sometimes I will put activist. It's like, who am I trying to appeal to, or what? And it's weird because it's like sometimes I want to fit into whatever crowd I'm playing to.
Right.
So sometimes I'm an activist, you know, and that's and I can prove it because I have pictures of myself with handcuffs on getting arrested, and you know. And other times I just want to be an advocate. I just want to be the buttoned up guy that, you know, goes to conferences and speaks up for the rights of people living with HIV, like myself. You know, I think to each his own. I kind of slip in and out of the two.
Yeah, yeah. What would you say you, Mark S. King, are trying to do with your blog, My Fabulous Disease? What's the overarching narrative? If you were able to go out there and visit with every reader and say, this is how I want you to be affected, what would you say you're trying to do?
I say that, A, I want to reflect what interests me.
Yeah.
And if it's interesting to me, I have to believe that it's interesting to you. And mostly it's about living with HIV, and it's about sexual politics and what it means in the here and now to be HIV positive. And for me, what that means is living joyfully and with engagement and with a sense of humor. It's funny because initially the blog, My Fabulous Disease, was a lot more funny. Yeah. I was kind of like that funny guy with HIV, you know, I would do funny little videos and stuff. And I think I did that because I wanted so much. I think at that time, and we're talking many years ago when I first started producing this, that it was important just to show people with HIV as having a sense of humor and living life and doing great and dating and all of that. My blog now tends to be a little bit more thoughtful and less flip about that sort of thing, and I don't get to do as much physical comedy as I used to, right. And that's a real bother. I wish I could do more pratfalls on my blog, but sometimes I guess I've gotten a little older and things strike me differently. You know, I'm going to be 55 years old in a couple of weeks.
I feel like The Price is Right was only 2 years ago.
Oh, do you? Well, yeah. Thank you. You know, and it's like I spent so many, well, quite a few years, a handful of years thinking, oh my God, I'll never live to 30.
Right.
And now I'm like, oh my God, I'm 55. You know, it's like, at what point do I get to actually start whining about aging?
Yeah.
as opposed to being grateful that I'm this old? I mean, when do I get to, you know, when do I get to just be like everybody else and whine about, oh, you know, I'm old. Yes, but all your friends are dead. Be happy you're alive. I know, but I have wrinkles. You know, I want to just complain about my wrinkles like everybody else, but it seems a little, you know, unfair.
I'm not going to stop you. I'm certainly not going to stop you. And you have your own blog. You could do it on there, too.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Well, let's talk about several different topics that have come up on My Fabulous Disease. Let's start with Charlie Sheen, which we briefly talked about a few weeks ago, but didn't give it that much airtime. You wrote about a moment with Charlie Sheen that we all may have missed. Talk to us about that.
There was this moment that had a lot of impact for me as somebody living with HIV, who has gone through the process of having to disclose in ways that were, you know, personal and difficult and all of that, and not knowing how people would respond. You know, I've been having to say I'm HIV positive for 30 years.
Right.
And over those years, sometimes it's been hard to say, whether it was to a potential boyfriend or somebody. So anyway, in his interview on the Today Show, he has his initial segment where he, you know, discloses he's HIV positive and all of that. And they go to commercial and they come back and Matt Lauer's like, oh, I have some tweets, some, you know, instantaneous responses. Yeah. Basically, he's saying, so we have, you know, instantaneous judgment for
right.
you, Charlie Sheen, on what, you know, the world via the public, you know, square of cyberspace has to say about you. And here it is. And Charlie Sheen just says, okay. And Matt Lauer starts reading. And the first comment is like, oh, you know, oh, you're so brave. You're so wonderful. Good for you. And Charlie Sheen's like, uh-huh. And he reads the second one. And it's something else positive. He needs to reach the third one. And it's something else going, you go, Charlie. Now you're winning because you're telling the truth and all of that. And they cut to this shot of Charlie Sheen, and he takes in a little air, and then his shoulders just go down. You just see him go, oh.
Yeah.
It's this moment that anybody who's ever had to disclose and face the judgment of the person they're sitting across of knows, and that is, oh, my God, it's okay.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's okay. It's going to be okay. Oh, they don't hate me. You know, now, I mean, obviously, this is early in the process. There'll be lots to say about Charlie Sheen. There'll be lots to judge about him and his choices and all of those things. But in that moment, Charlie Sheen was just this regular guy,
yeah,
taking in some little air and feeling a little bit of relief that the world, in that moment at least, was not crashing down upon him, but in fact, people were on his side, at least then. And it had a lot of impact. I really recognized it. I actually rewound and looked at it again. I went, yeah, that's him, you know, breathing out, you know, the sigh of, you know, many, many sleepless nights.
Yeah. Folks need to check that out. That piece is called The Charlie Sheen Moment You Probably Missed. Now, let's take a second, and I'm taking a deep breath here. Let's take a second to talk about Danny Pintaro, but I would like to not talk about Danny Pintaro. Okay, so this is how I'm going to approach this. So people can read your piece, How Do We Solve a Problem Like Pintaro? And people can listen to past episodes of this show where we've talked about it endlessly. And my goal is to not talk about Danny Pintaro. I would like to talk for a second about the responses to your piece and to a small degree my piece. Just this idea that folks were publishing afterwards, people in the LGBT community, and several folks, not just one or two, but several folks, saying we cannot be critical of each other. And it was less about Danny Pintaro and more about that we are not in a place, I think one executive director called it friendly fire. There's no place in the gay community for friendly fire. And I'm so fascinated to get your take on that. I will say for my part, I was extraordinarily taken aback by it. You know, I'm a college professor in Cleveland, Ohio, who writes occasionally for the Huffington Post and does this show, you know? And so I've never really had that response where people were writing to me saying, you are perpetuating gay on gay hate, which I didn't even know I was doing. I just thought, I thought in my own head, we are at a place where we can be critical of each other, respectfully critical of each other. I didn't know that we weren't in that place. So I would love to get your take on that without spending more of my airtime talking about Danny Pintaro.
Right. No, that's okay. And by the way, I'm not sure that the pushback against either of our pieces was all that tremendous, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
But I do think that there were those people who raised eyebrows or bristled at that. And the fact is that obviously we're not a monolithic community.
Right.
Obviously we have different opinions and strategies. Anybody who sat in an ACT UP meeting in 1989 knows that there are many very passionate people who disagree on the path forward,
right,
you know, or on any particular strategy, on or how somebody presented the latest issue, you know. I mean, hey, look, I get criticized all the time. Look at the contents of my blog. There's a lot of things that I have said, some of it I regret, some of it I don't, that has been met with controversy, and I've taken my lumps, you know. And I think that what it speaks to in this particular case is how desperately we needed and still need more high-profile people coming into the fold who are our ally. You know, we need it so desperately that sometimes we're willing to overlook, well, he's a little problematic, but, you know, we'll take what we can get. You know, ask any trans activist how their feelings with Caitlyn Jenner.
Right.
Know? And they'll say, well, you know, now, of course, apparently Caitlyn has now recently said things that they consider completely transphobic. And so now I think she's off the Christmas card list, you know.
Apparently, yeah.
We'll, you know, so I think that we all desperately want this person, but or as many people as we can get, and I agree with that. But the fact is that famous doesn't equal appropriate, doesn't equal well informed, doesn't equal a lot of things necessarily. And yes, of course we get to criticize how people are going. I'm not criticizing, in that particular case, I was not criticizing someone for being
right.
HIV positive.
Right.
You know, this is what I was critiquing was what I saw as a really messy sort of messaging and real problematic messaging, you know, that wasn't doing us any good.
Right.
Oh, he's famous. Well, that doesn't do us any good. If what, you know, the message is, now, that being said, HIV Plus magazine just published an interview with him in which he says all the right things,
yeah,
you know, about PrEP, about drug use among gay men, about, and so, you know, it's not as if anybody was banishing some new HIV celeb saying, don't ever speak up again, you know, shut up, you. I think we were critiquing what should have been probably, I think, our opinion was, this should have been better. These messages should be better. We need to be careful about this, because the fact is, it's a double-edged sword. You know, you get somebody out there and you go, yay, they're famous, listen to them. Oh, except that part. Oh, no, we don't like it. It's like, you know, and I think that that is absolutely legitimate. Of course it is.
Yeah. One of the things that you have written about so eloquently, among the many things you've written about so eloquently, is about stigma. And in your piece, The Sound of Stigma, you wrote this, quote, today our attitudes about HIV and other gay men range from self-righteousness to outright contempt. From whatever our vantage point, we have shamed and stigmatized everyone else into a corner, and the result is a community in revolt against itself. We are a snake eating its tail. So let's just pause here and say, by the way, not sure if I said this yet.
Wasn't that uplifting? That's a real. That was like, yeah, let's paint that quote on a flag and march through gay pride.
What I was about to say was to pause and say, which I have not yet said this interview. I love your writing, Mark. I mean, your turn of phrase is just so captivating. So let's put that out there. But what about stigma? If we gave that magic wand to Mark S. King, what would you do with it around stigma in the LGBT community?
Well, fortunately, I don't get to play that role, you know, or I get to have that magical power, but God knows what I do.
Yeah.
But I will say that it's clear that as medical progress has improved, social stigma has gotten worse amongst people living with HIV, people who were negative, gay men, and a lot of this has to do with, you know, we all know that resentments and just being catty and all of that stuff reverberates, you mm-hmm. know, in the internet barrel. And so automatically you have the sorts of no fats, no femmes, no, you know, no this, no that, no our HIV positive guys, that sort of thing. You know, we could erase HIV stigma. Let's say I waved my magic wand and HIV stigma was gone right now. So what? We'd all go back to hating fat guys and old guys or Asians or, you know, it's human nature, unfortunately, for us to separate out the other. Who is the other? How is he different from me? How can I criticize him so I feel better about myself? Because that's a popular human activity.
Yeah.
It's how can I, what's a lazy way, easy way for me to feel better about myself? Oh, I know him. Don't like him. I am better than. And so I think that that will always be going on. And I think that there's a limited amount that we can do about it when it comes to HIV stigma in any community, you know, most probably pointedly among gay men because we deal with it the most.
Right.
Now, that all being said, something I'm going to be working on this year is a really cool project called Bridging the Viral Divide, which is targeting gay men, and it is about how do we do this? What are some of the messages that we're putting out between HIV negative and HIV positive gay men back and forth that we're you know, what are those salvos that we're throwing across the divide at one another? And what are some ways that we can bridge that and find kind of a better community? And I'm doing that as a kind of a multimedia project with Avram Finkelstein.
Nice.
And Avram is one of the creators of Silence Equals Death,
yeah.
the iconic artwork. And so he has this process by which he takes groups of people through, you know, kind of this process where they boil down their thoughts on a particular issue. And we're going to do this with a group of HIV-positive gay men, and then with a group of HIV-negative gay men, where they're going to come up with these messages about their feelings toward the other side. And then we're going to bring them all together and create messages that bridge that divide.
Wow.
At least that's our goal. And that will be something that's released this year, and hopefully it will get some attention, because I just don't think it's talked about enough, nor do we really know kind of how to deal with it, or have gotten to the place where we know how to say, stop that. That's not cool.
Yeah. Wow, that's going to be an incredible project.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just for our listeners out there who are trying to hone their craft, can you tell us a little bit about how you go about creating new entries for your blog? Is there rhyme or reason to it? Do you sit in a certain place? Do you, you know, how does it work?
Oh, I'll tell you how it works. I have my computer on my dining room table, facing outside. I open it, I get a blank page, and I think for a second, and then I go to Facebook, and I read Facebook postings, and get distracted by that, and listen to something by Lady Gaga, and then I try to write a little bit, and then I get up because I've forgotten that I have taped Judge Judy from the day before, and I want to watch that, especially if it's about a dog attack. Don't ever leave your dog out of your control. That's always the message.
Yeah.
And then I go back to my computer, and I think some more. And about 2 weeks later, I go, oh, wait, I have an idea. This will be good. And I write that. I do not write every day. I'm not kind of one of those diarist type bloggers.
Right.
I write when I have something to say, when something's scratching me in the back of the head and I want to say something about it. And as a result, I only post every week. Sometimes a couple of weeks goes by, you know, and then stuff from my blog is shared with other outlets. You know, anybody can take my content. I'm happy for any website to grab content off my blog that they like and post it.
And everybody needs to just stroll on over to marksking.com, and it's all right there. Now, one of the great things about interacting with your work is that I have seen on more occasions, way too numerous occasions to count, just people writing comments and just saying, you know what, that opened their eyes in a different way. I would imagine you have had so many different interactions with people thanking you because I've seen it online. Talk to me about one of those interactions that particularly affected you.
One thing, you know, I'm as insecure as the next guy. You know, is anybody reading me or do they care or whatever? And one of the other things is I also know that, you know, relatively speaking, I am a privileged human being.
Right.
You know, I am a white gay man with health insurance, you know, and because people were reading my stuff all over the world, I thought, you know, there's a lot of people in this world who are much less fortunate, obviously. And I've received more than once emails from a person living in Africa who had to walk some distance to a community center where there was a computer and read something I had written and wrote me an email saying, I haven't laughed about having HIV in a long time. And until I read this today, this is very funny. Thank you. And God bless you. And, oh my God, you know, I have this little folder called my rainy day folder, and I take an email like that, it goes in the rainy day folder so that whatever, you know, there's a rainy day or I'm, you know, frustrated, whatever, I can look at that and it puts it in perspective. And so I think that's the thing. It's people that I am humbled to even know, you know, who take the time to write me, you know, in all of my grand privilege and to say, you know, what you said touched me, and thank you very much.
Yeah.
You know, that's really something. I thought you were going to ask me, you know, please tell my readers the best way to get on The Price is Right.
Hey, if you know, I think they're coming to Cleveland in a few weeks, so I am open
Are
to
they
that.
Really?
I am open to that information if you have
okay,
it.
You got to wear a military outfit. You got to have a sports shirt on. You got to jump up and down and be super, super bubbly. You know, like your life's work has all culminated in this one moment because they interview everyone standing in line.
Okay.
A guy comes by with a clipboard and has casual conversations. Don't be fooled. He's looking for contestants. So as soon as he gets near you, start jumping up and down.
Okay. Now, how important is the matching outfits?
Well, I wouldn't advise that.
Okay.
I wouldn't advise that at all because that probably worked against us. But wear a sports jersey, or if you've ever been in the military or even Cub Scouts, wear it.
Huh. I saw A Few Good Men once. Does that count? Because that's as close as I've ever come. All right.
I don't know. No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right. So I got to wear a Browns jersey, which I don't even know what those are. But okay. All right. That's the advice. Well, let me tell you something, Mark S. King. You have certainly helped my own craft. I have been reading your writing for quite some time. I will tell everyone, you have to go to anywhere fine books are sold and pick up A Place Like This, because it is written with such captivating honesty and accessibility, just even from a writing perspective. It will help you become a better writer, even as you are just completely immersed in your own memoir, which you give us such access, Mark. It's quite inspiring on so many different levels. But then over there at marksking.com, which everybody must stroll on over to, they can access so much of your content there. And you've made me a better writer, Mark, and you've inspired so many different people out there.
I don't even know how to respond to that, other than to say, happy holidays, and thank you so much.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have some time left on this week's episode, so let's get to the latest LGBT news that's out there. The big news that surprised so many of us, the Empire State Pride Agenda, New York State's LGBT statewide organization, they made a huge announcement just a few days ago that they would be disbanding. They are going to disband. The group's board voted last Saturday to wind down the operations of the Pride Agenda and their foundation in the first half of 2016 while maintaining their political action committee, which will continue to be involved in electoral politics, according to a press release from their organization. Board members determined that the Pride Agenda had accomplished its major goals, according to the press release. The realization of its last remaining major goal, which was protecting the rights of transgender state residents, with Governor Andrew Cuomo's October announcement of an executive order to do so, well, the release noted, hey, we've now accomplished everything we set out to accomplish. It listed other achievements in the state, including marriage equality, joint adoption by same-sex partners, non-discrimination laws covering sexual orientation, and a few more. The executive director of Empire State Pride Agenda, Nathan Schaefer, who was on our show years ago, he said this, quote, "We've accomplished amazing victories as an organization and as a community since our founding in 1990. The strides we have made towards equality and justice have been nothing short of extraordinary." Norman C. Simon, the group's chairman and a co-chairman of the foundation's board, told the New York Times this, quote, "The mission was to get these policy objectives passed, and we feel we have done that." He said that keeping the PAC alive would allow the group to maintain a continuing voice in electoral politics and guard against any undermining of LGBT rights. But many have expressed so much surprise and indeed a little bit of discontent at this news. State Senator Brad Hoyleman expressed surprise. He said this, quote, "There's a lot more work to be done on LGBT rights in New York, so declaring mission accomplished seems premature." He added that the Senate has not passed a single piece of LGBT legislation since 2011. He said this, quote, "I hope a new political group picks up the mantle." Speaking to the New York's Gay City News, Hoyleman expanded on his comments about the closure. He said this, quote, "I think there must be other forces at work here that are internal or financial." A supplementary Pride Agenda release acknowledged that fundraising challenges naturally coincide with mission victories, but stressed that this choice is mission-driven rather than being about whether or not Pride Agenda can remain fiscally solvent. Senator Hoyleman and others noted that among the work that remains undone is the passage of the long-stalled Gender Expression Non-Discrimination Act, which has been approved by the State Assembly several times but never the Senate. Although Governor Cuomo's executive order provides broad protections against discrimination based on gender identity and expression, it could be undone by a future governor. And Pride Agenda came in for some criticism for not mentioning gender in their initial press release. Although in the Sunday interview, that chairman of the board said the Political Action Committee will continue to advocate for gender. Senator Hoylman told Gay City News that he will still fight for gender as well as other LGBT rights measures, including a ban on the use of so-called ex-gay or conversion therapy on minors. Matt Foreman, who is a former executive director of the Pride Agenda, was particularly critical of the decision to close. He said this, quote, in an email message, he called the group's release appalling and said the job isn't half done. And that was reported by Gay City News. In a follow-up phone interview with the publication, Matt Foreman added this, quote, we are dealing with a political system and you need a political organization. Albany doesn't just respond to good ideas. So a lot of drama with the imminent closing of the New York State Pride Agenda, New York State's largest LGBT advocacy organization. I have to say it's a little bit disappointing news. There's so much left to do. And indeed, it's hard not to think that there's something else at play here. I would agree with Senator Hoylman. It has to be something internal or something financial. It just doesn't feel right to say, yep, we've done it. We've accomplished everything there is to do out there, because obviously there's so much else to do, not just with the Gender Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which, again, they try to pass so many times in New York. We have covered that so many times, and yet it cannot be passed there in the state of New York, but also with conversion therapy, also with additional protections for the trans citizens of New York State. So a little bit fishy. It's a little bit fishy there. Other news that's out there, this one's a little bit happier. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois is asking Pope Francis to rein in an anti-gay cardinal who has targeted the out U.S. ambassador to the Dominican Republic. Cardinal Nicolas de Jesus Lopez Rodriguez went so far recently as to denounce Ambassador Wally Brewster to reporters using a slur and saying he should, quote, focus on housework since he's the wife to a man, rather than get involved in his country's politics. According to Senator Durbin's letter to Pope Francis, the cardinal has even organized church-sponsored public protests against Brewster, who hails from Illinois and whom Durbin calls a personal friend. The Illinois Democrat makes it clear in his letter that Brewster is legally married according to the laws of the United States. Senator Durbin, who is Roman Catholic, also wrote that he accepts the challenge the Pope made in his historic address to a joint session of Congress to, quote, defend and preserve the dignity of all people, and he appealed to Pope Francis to step in despite church policy against marriage equality. Senator Durbin said this in his letter, quote, the church's teachings on gay marriage are well known, but the church also teaches us to show tolerance for those with different sexual orientations. The intolerant public statements of Cardinal Rodriguez are inconsistent with that clearly stated value. So there you go. A United States senator, a long-serving United States senator, writing a letter to Pope Francis to advocate for an out gay ambassador to the Dominican Republic. Very good. Very good. We like when people use their voices. When you see injustice, you have to say something, whether you're someone hosting a gay radio show or you're a senator or you're just listening, whatever it is, you got to use your voice. You got to use your voice. Speaking to Chuck Todd on Sunday's Meet the Press, I saw this. Florida U.S. Senator and presidential candidate Marco Rubio said he's still interested in reversing this year's Supreme Court decision, which established marriage equality nationwide. Senator Rubio said this, quote, I don't believe any case law is settled law. Any future Supreme Court can change it. And ultimately, I will appoint Supreme Court justices that will interpret the Constitution as originally constructed. While he declined to endorse a constitutional amendment that would overturn the case, because he said this, quote, that would be conceding that the current Constitution is somehow wrong and needs to be fixed, Senator Rubio said that each state should be allowed its own definition of marriage. He said this, quote, if you want to change the definition of marriage, then you need to go to state legislatures and get them to change it, because states have always defined marriage, and that's why some people get married in Las Vegas by an Elvis impersonator. Senator Rubio took several shots at the Supreme Court's narrowly decided marriage equality ruling. He said, quote, what is wrong is that the Supreme Court has found this hidden constitutional right that 200 years of jurisprudence had not discovered and basically overturned the will of voters in Florida, where over 60% passed a constitutional amendment that defined marriage in the state constitution as the union of one man and one woman. That is Senator Marco Rubio, Florida U.S. Senator and presidential candidate. He could not be more clear, my LGBT brothers and sisters, he could not be more clear that if elected, he will attempt to turn back all of the progress that we have made. So there you go. In the world of athletics, it's a great story. Watching the game from the owner's box at the Los Angeles Dodgers LGBT Pride Night last June was apparently a transformative moment for team executive Eric Braverman. As the Dodgers vice president of marketing and broadcasting, it had been Braverman, with the encouragement of his boss, longtime Los Angeles sports stalwart Lon Rosen, who helped launch the LGBT event several years ago. This year, the duo decided to amp up the event in a big way. They didn't want to just sell tickets. They aimed to shake things up in baseball by hosting an LGBT event that would get people talking not just about the Los Angeles Dodgers, but about the community in general. Billy Bean, the openly gay former Dodger, had been a part of the old-timers game earlier this year, and that couldn't have gone any better, according to many reports. The team was ready to wrap Dodger Stadium in rainbow, and that's exactly what they did. Braverman, this vice president of marketing and broadcasting, he stood in the owner's box that night midway through the ballgame and took in the atmosphere that just years ago he thought was literally impossible, and then he came out. Now, many in the LGBT community already knew that Braverman was an out gay man. He's well known in the local and national gay softball leagues. His life is full of gay friends, and his weekends often find him straying into the gay bars along Robertson and Santa Monica Boulevards. But this was the first time that he had publicly came out. He said this quote, "I didn't want anyone to in any way not view me for the quality of my work. I don't want to be known as the gay executive who happens to run marketing and broadcasting for the Dodgers. I want my accomplishments and my job to be first and foremost and speak for themselves." But regardless, he did come out, and this is a huge deal. Anytime someone comes out in the world of athletics, we have to take note because there are so few folks who are out in the world of athletics. So congratulations to Los Angeles Dodgers executive Eric Braverman, who has come out as gay in part to inspire youth. So well done there. In Savannah, the City Council of Savannah, Georgia, this week approved an ordinance that will protect current and prospective city government employees from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The vote by the mayor and the members of the council was unanimous, according to Georgia Equality, that group that does such amazing work. We just had the executive director on our show just a few months ago, for adding sexual orientation and gender identity to the list of protected characteristics in the city's non-discrimination ordinance. Savannah received praise from Georgia Equality, who said this in a statement, quote, "Savannah has long enjoyed a reputation of being a welcoming and diverse city, and this ordinance is an important step towards ensuring lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people feel safe and protected when visiting or residing in Savannah. Georgia Equality will continue to work with members of the city council and the mayor to add additional necessary protections for LGBT people into the city code." So congratulations to everyone there in Savannah, Georgia, and certainly to our colleagues there at Georgia Equality, who clearly have done amazing work to support this big change. And finally, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health is, quote, "winding down their gender identity services for children and youth after an external review found its approach was out of step with currently accepted practice." The Center for Addiction and Mental Health made the announcement this week after releasing the report by two independent reviewers who were tasked earlier this year with assessing their services. This is an organization that's in Toronto. The review was sparked by criticisms from the transgender community and others that their clinic, headed by psychologist Dr. Ken Zucker, was practicing reparative or conversion therapy on young people who were questioning their physical gender. The reviewers said in their report that they were unable to ascertain whether the clinic was in fact practicing reparative therapy, a charge that their staff had denied, but the two psychiatrists said the clinic appeared to operate as a fairly insular entity with a focus on, quote, "intensive assessment and treatment." Current practice is dealing with gender questioning children and youth favors watchful waiting while educating and supporting parents to accept a gender expression. Again, folks, instead of embracing reparative therapy or conversion therapy, which has been proven by every single medical establishment out there to actually hurt the patient, it doesn't work and it actually hurts the patient. The actual accepted practice would be watchful waiting while educating and supporting parents to accept a child's gender expression. Not to try to repair something that isn't broken. Not to try to convert something that can't be converted. So there you go, a big step. I'm seeing a lot of social media posts out there about the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, the fact that they are winding down their gender identity services. Many are seeing this as a huge step forward and hopefully will inspire any number of other clinics to really move away from reparative therapy, get away from conversion therapy. It doesn't work and it does harm. So look up in your local community if there is a place that is practicing conversion therapy. You definitely want to make your voice be heard. This is, again, another topic that Empire State Pride Agenda could be focusing on. I'm still back at our first story that Empire State Pride Agenda is going to be closing their doors with the umbrella message that, hey, we have accomplished what we set out to accomplish. There is so much else to accomplish. So get out there, folks. You know that you need to use your voice. You need to help out. So that's it for this week's episode of The Show Is So Gay. Our huge, huge thanks to Mark S. King. What an absolute treat having him on our show. You have to check out his blog, My Fabulous Disease. The turn of phrase that he puts out there in the world really will open your eyes. He is an unbelievably talented writer, but he also takes these events that we're seeing covered all over social media or all over the media in general, and he just refocuses them in a really beautiful way and entertaining. He's funny. He's funny. So stroll on over to marksking.com and read all about how he uses words to make a difference in the world. On next week's show, happy to tell you, the comic performer Devin Green will be on our show. What a treat it will be to host her. Many people know her as Betty Bowers, America's favorite conservative Christian in that satire, but she is so much more than that. She's got so many funny words to share with all of you, and she's out there fighting for equality, so excited to host her on the show. But in the meantime, you guys know what to do. You need to get out there and use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. However it is that you do that best, I don't know what it is, but you do. Whether you are a writer, whether you are a singer, whether you want to pen a letter to your local editor to decry something that you see going on, you have to use your voice. I promise you it will make you feel better because you're not going to be bottling that up, and it will make a difference for somebody else. You using your voice to make a difference will inspire your brothers and sisters out there who need that inspiration. So get out there, use your voice to make a difference, and please remember, while you're using your voice, why be gay when you can be so gay?
You say you're all right, it's just my mistake, and I'm feeling that something has startled you away. No, I've never seen you this way. Don't know what to expect. Now you're turning to the doorway. I'm not all you have left. If I let you leave, would you be alright? Would you be okay? Would you be smiling? Or would you be crying? Wiping the tears off, saying you're sorry, saying that you'll be better tomorrow. I've stayed, I've stuck out, I've picked up after you. I've fallen, I messed up, I've listened to the truth. Now you